This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
Our first guest today is William Strample. Bill is the dean of MSU's College of Osteopathic Medicine. Here's President Simon.
It really is a pleasure to welcome Bill Strample, dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Michigan State, and really a leader in the field of medicine in general, as well as with osteopathic medicine. So, Bill, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Many people may be unfamiliar with osteopathic medicine and the fact that Michigan State had, I think, one of the first college, university-affiliated College of Osteopathic Medicine. So you may want to give a bit of history. And
I can give you a brief history. Osteopathic medicine basically came out of the Civil War. Andrew Taylor Still was an MD physician during the Civil War that lost his wife and one of his daughters to spinal meningitis. And those were the days that they treated meningitis with arsenic, lead, calomel, which was mercury, and other heavy metals. And it probably was the standard of, it was the standard of care then, but he thought there could be something better. And over 10 years after the Civil War, he began to look around, and he divined a system that said that structure follows function, or function follows structure, and that basically the body has an inherent ability to heal itself, and that if you don't mess with that too much by giving people poison, a lot of them will get better. And he corrected some certain things, and he became very successful. And why he was successful, it originally started in the Midwest in the 1880s. If it had started on the East Coast, it would have been absorbed by mainstream medicine. I'll give you an example. In 1825, there were 179 medical schools in the United States. 26 of them were homeopathic medical schools, and 23 of them were eclectic. And I won't go into what those differences are. But a homeopathic medical school was in Michigan. In fact, it was in Ann Arbor. Was a homeopathic medical school, and it was absorbed by mainstream medicine. And osteopathic medicine's success is that since the 1880s, 1890s, we've remained a separate and equal branch of medicine in the United States and has grown, licensed in all 50 states, 64 countries worldwide. Michigan State was the sixth college of osteopathic medicine and really created the explosion. There are now 31 colleges of osteopathic medicine, most of them now affiliated with major universities. In fact, the newest one on the drawing board will be the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Auburn University that will go live in 2014.
One of the things that I think has been so important for the state of Michigan is that the college is embedded in many communities across the state.
We've always believed in community-immersed education. We believe if you want somebody to stay in Michigan, they must, number one, they should be a Michigan resident. And I'm not talking about they come here as a graduate student to become a Michigan resident. I'm talking about their parents and grandparents lived here. So about 85% of my admission class are Michigan residents. Number two, we train in communities all across, 41 different hospital partners across the state of Michigan. And I believe what we do is we show the students that they can get great education in Muskegon. One of the best OB programs in the state is in Muskegon, Michigan, and in Benton Harbor and in Grand Rapids and in Flint and Traverse City, Lansing, and all around the Detroit metro area. And that's what our strength has been. We're spread out, but we train great students in those locations.
As Mark and I get older, one of the real concerns is both a physician shortage as well as having physicians who are able to deal with an aging population. I'm a little bit older than Mark, so he may not worry about this as much as I do. But college has played an important role in this.
Yeah, more than that. About 6 years ago, we looked at that number was going to be very short in Michigan, even without the Affordable Health Care Act. We knew there was going to be a shortage of physicians in those areas. So we began to expand our class. We went from a class size of 125 to 150 to 200 to 300. Now this year, 315 students in three locations, in Metro Detroit, Macomb, and Lansing campus. And we looked at the strength we have is I have graduate education positions for not only my students, but I have two graduate education positions for every student I have. So we are a net exporter of graduate education positions, which brings doctors to train in the state, which makes it stronger. Just like pediatrics is not taking care of small adults, geriatrics is not just is a different kind of a medicine than taking care of somebody that's 40 or 50. And we just opened a brand new geriatric residency program downtown Detroit with the Wayne County Health Authority. And I think that, and we have a HRSA grant for $900,000 looking at how do we improve geriatric education within the college and at Michigan State University.
Growing up on the shores of Lake Huron, Dr. John Bell was my family doctor at DO. And, you know, I've kind of always sat back as a kid and I wondered, what's the difference? What's the difference between a DO and an MD? And could you walk through a brilliant young student undergrad at Michigan State that's looking to get into the field of medicine and why that individual may choose to go one direction or the other? And then once out, what's the difference in training? What's the difference in residency? What's the difference maybe in specialization?
On the science part, in all medical schools, MD or DO medical schools are essentially divided up in 2 years of undergraduate basic science education, the first 2 years, clinical education in the last 2 years. And when you graduate at the end of those 4 years, you get a degree, either DO, which I hope, or MD. Mm-hmm. But then in Michigan and all the states in the United States now, you must go on to postgraduate education. Those are the interns and residents you hear about so that you can practice. So it's key for any I could train first and second year medical students in this room. It's a blackboard, and I could teach them biochemistry and physiology. But the clinical component, your last 2 years in the hospital are vital. And that's where you have to have the bench strength, and we do have that bench strength. We have 41 partner hospitals. I have at any one time more than enough students. I have about 800 students, 900 in the state at any one time, and they're not all mine, but they're in our partner hospitals to do that. The difference really comes down to this. 120 years ago when we started, mainstream medicine believed that there was a medicine to cure everything. That's Dr. Carter's little liver pills, you remember? I'll give you a good example.
It's a Tom Izzo line.
Well, I'll give you an example. You guys and I grew up watching Father Knows Best. Mm-hmm. What was one of the advertisers on Father Knows Best? Geritol. And they used to do that. You have 2 tablespoons of Geritol at night, and it gave you vim and vigor and picked up. Well, Geritol was 60% alcohol. So it was essentially the equivalent of 2 martinis before you came home. Those were the kind of patent medicine things there. Osteopathic medicine believed that I didn't need to give you necessarily drugs for everything, although we do prescribe and everything. But if you've got a shoulder out of place or you've got a sprained ankle, the first thing I would look at is not just put ice on it, elevate it, and put an ACE wrap on it. I'd look at your knee because your knee is connected to your ankle through your fibula. And we know that if we correct the fibula displacement, your ankle, sprained ankle, will get better faster, which is why osteopathic medicine does so well in sports medicine for major athletic teams and Michigan State and all sorts of other venues across the nation. Mm-hmm. So it's the manipulative aspect that we train all of our young providers to do on top of their physiology, biochemistry, microbiology, all those other things to do is the single probably biggest difference. And I think the other big difference is we touch people.
And for those of us with ailments, we thank you.
Yeah. Well, I think this is an important distinction because so many of us, when you think about what would escalate healing, and you think about the problems in sport today, people have gone to drugs and things that are illegal in many ways in order to try to find faster recovery. Whereas some of these connections and ways in which you treat sprains, other kinds of structural issues can be actually improved dramatically through the approach that osteopathic medicine has taught for many years.
Right. And still, the founder really looked at it that everything was interconnected. I like to use the example because we all go to art museums and you see these art structures where you have these blocks that are kind of standing on each edge and they're held together by those wires. And the only thing supporting that whole thing is those wires. And it's in the engineering term for that is tensegrity. But your body's spine and your ligaments are all connected from your neck all the way down to your ankles. And when something's out of alignment, if I put a nickel in your shoe and you walked around all day, you'll have neck pain from what's in your shoe. And that's not magic. There's not witchcraft to that. We've learned that if something's out of alignment, if we can make that look better, you feel better faster than taking Motrin or Tylenol with codeine or something when somebody has bad back pain to do that. Those studies are in. Osteopathic manipulative therapy does a lot better for low back pain in the early stages of that than trying to treat it with the non-steroidals or even the pain medicine to do that.
one of the things that's happened, going back to Dr. Brum is and Dr. Greenbaum, is really the number of athletes from around the world who actually come here to be part of the treatment paradigm of your physicians. So how did that develop, and this sort of real interest about sports medicine and the kind of reputation, talk to people about the kind of reputation you have in this area?
I think with Phil Greenman and Lynn Brum, and Lynn's still alive. Yeah, I saw Lynn just last week. I think it was they had a result. Somebody said, "Can you do something with it?" And they did it. And we have a hockey player that played for the Buffalo Sabres. They used to fly Lynn Brum out to Buffalo to take care of him, and he attributes Lynn in keeping him in his career in pro hockey for 3 more years than he would have ever been there to do this. I think it was that somebody said, "I'm hurting. This isn't working right," and these guys, and Phil, and you know Dr. Greenman, yeah. Phil was a true master. And I think that they were not afraid to say, well, let me try this. And when somebody let him try it and it worked for that. Our own comptroller at the university that just retired, he asked me one day, he was limping around with his back, and I got him hooked into Lisa or Sherm Gorbis, and he's now been a convert. Every time he has a problem, Dave's over there with them, calls me up directly to do that.
Well, and then you also, to do the other piece of this, have very sophisticated neuroscientists as a part of the college. So it's not simply family care or sort of manipulative medicine as it relates to sports medicine, but the role that your college is playing, David Kaufman, with athletes and concussions. It might be important for you to mention that.
Sure. We in Central Michigan area, we have about 80% of the neurology in general, and pretty much about 90% of the interventional neurology and neurology stuff here to do that. And osteopathic medicine, there are osteopathic physicians that are forensic pathologists, OBGYN, neurosurgeons. We have a neurosurgeon here in town that's my alumni. We have all of those things because we like to say we want our students to be interested in family medicine, primary care, and we still get about 60% that still go to do that. But you have a lot of them that come in and really get turned on by pediatrics. 80% of the primary pediatrics in the Lansing market is Michigan State health teams, that most people don't even realize that to do this. Or we have a pediatric orthopedics here guy that's there to do this. So they get turned on by something and they can go into any element in medicine. We still pride ourselves that our roots are in primary care family medicine, but I have young men and women that come in today that already know they want to be a neurosurgeon when they grow up to do that.
I think as an AD, we're so blessed to have so many different medical backgrounds that really originated out of here. Dr. Lanny Johnson, who was an MD, but was a pioneer.
We don't discriminate.
But that's the value of being the athletic director, is to have those different walks. The manipulation, Dr. Brum's curriculum, through our trainers, through our sports medicine team. You know, I personally have been rescued so many times. I know Roy's been rescued a few times from aggravating pain that is remarkably different than the medicine field. But I think there's other curriculums as well that you kind of broadly oversee in so many different ways. And that's talking about individuals that are student athletes that are part of our community who have issues with nutrition, who have issues from a psychological standpoint, some challenges that maybe need to be addressed. And your department really reaches out to athletics in so many different capacities beyond just the normal research and teaching that you do as the DO program.
It was a natural. And the reason is it goes back to Still's response that the body has an inherent ability to heal itself. Nutrition and the elements of nutrition are extremely important. If you're malnourished in some way, you can't function at your peak. No matter how much you train, you'll never get there. Mm-hmm. So the guys we have in sports medicine, nutrition, it all interfaces with what we're doing. And it was a natural to add sports medicine, nutrition to the sports medicine department. It just was a right fit for us to do that.
We continue to find ways to strengthen that, make it even stronger. So it's much valued.
So in closing, I think all of our listeners have heard about the Affordable Care Act.
Okay, I'd be surprised if they hadn't.
Right, so for medical school, what does that mean? And for physicians that are going to be graduating over the next few years, what does that really mean if you're a parent thinking about a kid going into medical school?
I think for the medical schools, the impact of the Affordable Care Act is not as direct as it will be for people who are deciding on purchasing insurance. People who want to go into medicine, I mean, you on the fringe, you might get somebody change their mind if they're not making quite as much money. But the majority of people that go into medicine, both MD or DO, go into it because they have this desire to help people. I mean, that freely, that's there. So the fact of life is that the Affordable Care Act for medicine may mean that 10 years from now, the average radiologist will not make $600,000 a year. They'll make $300,000 a year, which is okay. Because if you didn't make $600,000 to begin with, you'll be okay at $300,000. The biggest problem is those providers that are making $600,000 now in that transition to come down, and that will be where you hear the bad thing. I personally believe I've read most of the 2,000 pages of the Affordable Care Act.
You may be one of the few people in America who can say that.
I had to testify to the health care committee for the legislature downtown, ask them for my opinion. And I spoke to 400 people along with Senate Majority Leader Richardville and Bolger and Gretchen Whitmer, Senate Minority Leader, and the other Democrat. And I was making the point that I'm a fan of certain elements. I think what they need to do, the Affordable Care Act, is not repeal it, but to go through it with a Marxalot and take everything that has nothing to do with health care and block that out and go with the thing. There's some great things. Students being covered till 26 by their parents' insurance. I went through that with my daughters graduating from Michigan State. I had to buy a major medical policy until they got a job, so that I knew they didn't have a major event. Now that would be something I wouldn't have to worry about. I think healthcare reform will provide eventually everybody to have a basic level of healthcare. And let's be honest, we've been paying for everybody's healthcare, whether they had insurance or not. And it's an illusion to not believe we're not paying for it. So having everybody on a basic level, and then you can add on to that, I think makes wonderful sense. For a country that we want to take care of our people, we need to be taking care of our people.
So part of it will be an evolution of fine-tuning from your perspective. And for somebody who wants to be a physician, it's still going to be a great time to be a physician.
Absolutely. And I do think it's an evolution. Our biggest problem is we need more discussion rather than more dogma. Yeah, I don't mind arguing with somebody, but if we can move to...
I've never really noticed that.
Oh, sorry. But if we disagree, as long as we can have a discussion and it doesn't be just block everything. But right now we seem to be in the mode in the political nature of the country that everything is a win-lose, and it doesn't have to be. Everything in life is a negotiation. I've been married almost 50 years. Believe me, everything is a negotiation.
Well, I think it is important to underscore a point that you made. For those of us, I'll pick Michigan State, in our insurance premium and all the people we have who are working for us who didn't see themselves benefited by the Affordable Care Act, we're actually paying for the uninsured through our premiums, the cost of what happens at the hospital, a lot of things that are hidden. In the same way, America is really paying for premier athletes because every time that we buy tickets and advertise and pay the television rights, we're all sort of chipping in a small amount. We just don't notice it. Mm-hmm. And I think the Affordable Care Act has the potential, if we can get it right, and throw out all the, as you say, the dogma and all the things that don't really matter, to make that much more transparent. Our own experience here with our employees is the more that we've made the real cost transparent, the more they've been a partner in not only worrying about wellness, but also worrying about the cost of healthcare.
Oh, I agree with that. And I mean, it's so, you can't figure out a hospital bill. I mean, because there's so many different things in there, and I would rather have it be transparent. Mm-hmm. That the bill, if I know I'm having a gallbladder surgery, that bill should be transparent so I know what gallbladder surgery cost me or my insurance. You can't figure that out today. One hospital may be $8,000 and another hospital in the same state may be $20,000. What's the difference? It's not a quality difference.
Right.
The surgery is the surgery. That's what we need, is to figure this out so that we know the real cost of what we're providing.
And also the transparency of the quality measures.
Absolutely.
And I know that that's something that you work on with our partners around the state. It's not simply placing students. Is it worrying about quality and transparency?
I believe that that's very important in education of any young physician, to give them that piece so that we know what they're learning is appropriate for what they're learning and it's the right thing to learn.
Thanks very much, Bill, for your leadership, not only for Michigan State, but for the field of osteopathic medicine and for the state of Michigan.
Well, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
That was the dean of MSU's College of Osteopathic Medicine, Bill Strample, talking with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis. To hear their conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com. Up next, youth sports is the topic as Simon and Hollis welcome Dan Gould to the program. Dan leads MSU's Institute for the Study of Youth Sports.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to a half a million Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
MSU Today is online at SpartanPodcast.com. Here's Russ White.
And here's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with Dan Gould. Dan leads MSU's Institute for the Study of Youth Sports.
One of the things that is extraordinarily important as you think about the evolution of the College of Education and the work that we've done is the extraordinary science that's been a part of thinking about sport. And the college, the Department of Kinesiology, does a lot of things that is not the old PE. It's not your what you would imagine in that department. It's extraordinarily science-based. And Don Gold has been a part of that work for a very long time. And one of the emphasis we've had is worrying about youth in sport. From a physiological perspective, a psychological perspective, and also the nature and culture of sport. So it's really a pleasure for me to introduce somebody I've known for a very long time and someone who really is the head of our Institute for the Study of Youth Sports. So, Dan, thank you for being here. And tell people what occupies your time these days as you think about the issues of youth and sport.
Yeah, well, the Institute's been around for almost 30 years now, and we're started by the legislature of the state of Michigan because they had concern about children in sport. And our purpose is pretty simple, to scientifically study the benefits and detriments of sport for children and youth, and as you alluded to, physical, psychological, social, and then to partner with organizations to help enrich communities in Michigan and nationwide, to really help families do a better job so kids get benefits from sport. So some of the things that we're working on, we're doing a lot of work right now on sport parents and how to help them be optimally involved. Like Jim Pavarnik of our department studies pregnancy and exercise. And if moms are more, when they're pregnant, active, they tend to have kids that have some physical benefits. So we know we need parent involvement and physical activity at a very young age. But then the more we talk to high school coaches, you hear about the over-involved parent and, you know, kind of the crazy sport parent. And yet our research shows 7 out of 10 parents are pretty darn good, and there's, you know, one or two that get overexcited. So how do we help educate that parent and the coaches so it's better for the kids?
Well, Dan, this radio show is not going to be enough time for all the questions that I have for you. I think we need a mini series to get much of it out. But it's interesting that as you look at our media today, the attention and the focus that's being placed on a topic that you do a great amount of research in, the entitlement word that's used so much of young kids coming up, whether it be in sports or just in general. Much of the conversation's been about a child's lifestyle getting impacted early on based upon sport and evolving through college and then into the workplace. And it's the trophy for everyone mentality. It's the intensity that perhaps a college coach will deliver to a student athlete for the first time when they've always received nothing but praise and that whole process. And I don't even know how to dabble into this because it's a very broad concept, but it's something that is concerning to those of us in intercollegiate athletics, because what we're seeing from a coaching perspective, we were just talking about it earlier, is coaches have had an opportunity to evolve with changing students as they come in, and now it's changing so fast that the pace and the ability to keep up has been quite a challenge for coaches in all sports, frankly.
Yeah, that's a great point. There's a lot of challenges today. On one hand, we know at the youngest ages, kids need very positive experiences in sport. They need to feel good about themselves, feel successful, feel competent. And at the same time, they also need to learn life lessons like responsibility,
And losing and winning,
and when does that come in the formula? And there's a lot of interesting research right now on athletic talent development, and kids go through phases like fun and fundamentals.
Right.
So you don't want too early of sports specialization. You want to try multiple sports, do things like that. Then they learn how to train, and then they train to train, and then like here at Michigan State, they're training to perform and win.
Right.
And it's a developmental progress, and some of our research now looks at responsibility and how kids are, how you can as a coach kind of have a positive environment,
mm-hmm.
but it's not always fun. Yeah. In fact, we have a study of an intensive wrestling camp now that we're dubbing, it's just underway, Navy SEAL training meets positive youth development, because the coach is very interesting that he physically, with the kid's choice and parents, pushes kids, but then talks a lot about lessons in life, and they have reflective journals at night. So it's a real interesting combination of how you can use physical activity to learn some life values. But some of those lessons are tough, and mm-hmm. it's really important for kids to learn how to lose as well as win. And I think over the years, we've been so concerned with the self-esteem, which is important, that we forgot. It's not just about being positive. It's important to be contingent.
Yep.
So you have to earn it.
When I grew up in Lexington, Michigan, which is up in the Thumb, and I was at Meyer Elementary School, and there was the dreaded rope.
Mm-hmm.
And as a young child, I mean, it still sits with me today. There's three categories. There's the people that didn't try, there's the people that tried and failed, and there's the people that made it to the top. And I think, you know, I was in that first category for a long time. I was scared to death to try because you'd see, and, you know, I can't do that. I was probably as proud of the time I tried and didn't make it to the top as the time I made it to the top. And it's the ropes are non-existent in elementary schools today, and part of that's probably because of safety, and part of it is probably because parents have said, I don't want my child put in that condition of being bullied from being in the category of not trying. But as you go through and you watch baseball, softball, soccer, at what age is it okay to learn how to lose? At what age is it okay to make that transition from T-ball where everybody runs around the bases to actually there's a winner and a loser, and it should hurt a little bit to lose, and it should feel good to win, and when you lose, there's life lessons that you're going to carry with you for the rest of your life.
Yeah, great question. I don't think we have an exact answer, but I would say there's a lot of research that shows around 11 or 12, kids developmentally and cognitively change so they can understand winning and losing more like an adult. They can differentiate between effort and ability. So to me, your entry programs, you know, below 10, 11, Mm-hmm. 11 or 12, you don't throw them off the deep end into a cutthroat competitive environment, but then maybe in competition becomes more a part of it. You win sometimes, you lose sometimes. And I think a lot of it's the environment the coach creates. Because we've studied coaches. We have a partner in Detroit, Think Detroit Police Athletic League, that does a great job down there. But we studied some of their coaches who are more versus less effective. And overall, they do a great job. And I applaud them because they weren't afraid to study internally. But their less effective coaches felt you had to toughen kids up in Detroit and yell at them and be on them all the time. And the youth development literature shows that isn't necessarily the best strategy. At the same time, just always being positive. And it's sort of this collaborative approach where you hold kids to standards. They know the expectations. If they fail, you might feel bad because they fail, but they have to sort of live with the consequences. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you're trying to catch them doing things right. So coaching is sort of this delicate art. Just like it is in business or other things, when I hear President Simon talk about support and challenge, how do I support the faculty and how do we challenge us to go places we've never been because we're in such a competitive world environment today? And it's this delicate balance that we're trying to find as coaches or leaders. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what we're doing is trying to help parents, coaches, and leaders figure that out. There's a researcher that talks a lot about, as a parent, when do you intervene to protect your child? And when do you let your child fail? Mm-hmm. And the hardest thing for a lot of parents today is to let their child fail because that could be, as John Wooden would say, mistakes are the building blocks of success. And it's okay to make a mistake, even though your instinct as a parent is to jump in and protect your child. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of parents have that balance wrong today for good intentions. Mm-hmm. But we're trying to help provide information. Some of our studies have pointed to something called optimal parent push. As a parent, you stress values, hard work, you make a commitment to the team. Yeah, you went to the sleepover Saturday night, but yeah, you still have to go to practice the next day or whatever it is. And at the same time, the parents aren't totally tied to outcome and winning. Mm-hmm. Winning's important. In fact, we've done studies of Olympic champions. They follow this pattern. The parents emphasize values. Do it, you do it right, follow through. But they don't get too hung up on if you're winning or losing. Or we see a lot of parents now crazy about getting their kid a scholarship. And I always say...
A full scholarship.
Yeah. And I say, go to the library. Yeah. Your chances are about 150. We want them in sports. Yeah. But, you know, so it's just sort of like focus on the process, teaching these life lessons, and you're going to have better results in the long run.
Well, I think that's the real value of your research is connecting the sport to life after college, and it's that whole transition process is what's interesting. ESPN just had a fabulous series on youth sports and the evolution into college, and Bob Knight was actually part of that conversation, but it was dealing with confrontation for the first time, and it went into, you know, the term that's heavily used is the helicopter parent, and talked about the communication that takes place between today's college students and their parents is in the range of 5 to 6 times daily, where, you know, it was maybe 5 to 6 times a semester when I was going through school. And it's not only the parents, it's other individuals that are part of their lives that are feeding information and what that information does to the psyche that concerns you or you know, much of it is well-intended. Some of it is well-intended for the individual that's providing the feedback. But that feedback has evolved into things like Twitter and social media and blogs and newspaper articles, especially when you get into some of the more elite athletes in soccer or baseball or football and the like. And it creates almost a sense of greatness that supersedes the reality of their work ethic that they've put into that point, if that... I don't even know if I'm asking a question right
but
now.
I think it's the whole entitlement. If you're talented when you're young and everybody tells you you're great, so then you do something at school that would normally mean you don't play that night, but we need to win the game, so I let you play.
Right.
And then everybody's treating you special, and now you get to Michigan State, and, you know, it's sort of like, I think I own the place, and, well, why do I need to follow through? And then you play for some of our top coaches like Coach Izzo and D'Antonio that sort of have rules. Imagine it's a rude reality waking for some young people.
Like, it also translates, I think, academically, because many students who come to Michigan State have been very actively involved in some aspect of sport prior to coming. They've soccer leagues, because soccer leagues are something that most communities do. It helps leadership, so they write down they were on the varsity team and they did all of these kinds of things. And they just expect that once they finish high school, they're not going to play at any level that is a Division I. So they're going to come to a high level D1 school to get an education, and they come with a little bit of that entitlement philosophy too, as it relates to gee whiz, not going to the math tutoring we're offering right now in the residence halls, or gee whiz, I'm really good, so somebody should be doing something for me instead of me being responsible for asking the professor a question. And there's a little bit of bleed over, as we've gotten so many, I think appropriately, so many kids in organized sport throughout their K-12 experience.
But in education, as a parent, those are things you wrestle with in the academic side.
Right.
Is when do you stop calling the teacher and push your child to say, you go ask the teacher why you got this grade, or you go ask the teacher what you're missing.
Right.
And it's coaching the child. And so
it's the same. I think some of the issues that are part of the research of youth sport also occur as I think about the way in which students engage with us, because we do have high expectations. The expectations here for performance are higher than some other places they could go. That's mm-hmm. what they're paying for. Mm-hmm. But at the same time...
These are great points. And I think sport in many ways is a microcosm of society. So 30 years ago, we didn't have parent orientation when we brought campuses. Now we have helicopter parents here that are concerned about their kids.
You're listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
And you're listening to a conversation between Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon, Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis, and Dan Gould, leader of MSU's Institute for the Study of Youth Sports.
And then I think a mission of Michigan State is for us to study things like social media, parenting, and then disseminate that information to the public, because as a parent, you're scared today. It's the first generation where the Gallup polls tell us you don't expect your kids to be as successful as you are. You're worried about the competitive world, so you're really trying to protect your kid. And parents are doing the things for the right reason, but I think they make some fundamental flaws sometime without knowing it. And I haven't been a parent myself and raised kids. There's this urge to protect them. And the worst thing to do is sit at a basketball game and just keep my mouth shut and let them play. And then when do you say a couple things? And I'm trained and felt that pressure to intervene. So I think if we can make parents, we've had really good luck with parent education. We're also doing things with kids. We work with the Michigan High School Athletic Association for a number of years now doing captains leadership training. Because there's this notion that captains learn how to lead. Most of our research shows that coaches do very little to teach captains how to lead. So Michigan is very innovative, the High School Association, and we do programs to train kids how to lead. And a really good example would be, how do you confront? How do I tell my best friend when I'm a junior in high school that she's not working hard enough? And with a peer pressure, that's hard for adults to do. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there that we can do to really help kids and parents. And I think their motives are good. It's just that we need to get good information out to them, tips for helping kids learn responsibility, for not being, not developing entitlement, lack of a better word. And some of it is, I'll say tough love, but it's hard as a parent to watch that your kid look disappointed when you're disciplining them. And I think we need to get back to some of that, find this right balance.
Let me shift gears, because even the President of the United States has got into the act about sports injuries, focusing on football in particular. You have, at that one level, you have the high-profile NFL issues at another. So how what are you seeing in terms of this issue of management of injuries? Because you've looked at this for a very long time. So what's changed? What's better today? What's worse?
It's a great question. There's a we have a great researcher in our department, Tracy Kovacin, who studies concussions and learning a lot about concussions. And, you know, the good news is we're finding things out. And then a lot of it, like I know Coach D'Antonio, they were working together on a proper tackling and football video. So I think we can do some things about injuries. But historically, if we look at injuries in youth sports, prior to puberty, the injury rates are fairly low. After puberty is when you get one kid at Little League World Series that has a mustache at 12 and another kid that's about 4 foot tall, and they're together, you get more injuries there. There is some inherent risk in sport, any sport. Knee injuries in girls in basketball is a higher incident than boys. There's a variety of reasons for that. Doesn't mean they shouldn't play, but it probably means we need better qualified coaches, more work on preventative medicine so we don't give girls the same weight program that we've given boys because anatomically they're different, hormones are different, et cetera. So I think a lot of it, again, is good at coach education. And in America, we don't do a very good job with that. You need a hat and whistle to coach youth sports. And the more we can inform coaches, the more we can prevent some of these injuries. But it's a fact of life. I think we're getting a lot of press on it right now. But education, to me, is the answer in that.
Let me sort of ask the difficult question about what I would call what if you're in the NCAA venue or the NFL, you're going to call performance-enhancing drugs that have been banned. If you're out in the world that I see at gyms and health food stores and everything that is sort of how do I make myself healthier, some of which includes substances that might be on these lists later on, but they're not necessarily illegal. They're not banned by high schools. They're not banned by midget hockey teams. They're all just okay. But they do produce effects for youth that then carry over either when they have to be continued now illegally, or they put a kid at risk for having done this for a while and then stopping because now they're being monitored by some nefarious organization.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. First, if you look at the whole supplement industry, it's unregulated. And I know my work with the Olympic Committee over the years is you tell your top athletes you don't take anything without a person who's U.S. Anti-Doping Agency approved kind of saying it's okay to take because you buy it off the shelf at the store. You don't know what you're getting. So that's, I think, part of it. We need from just a protection to stay out of trouble as an athlete, don't put stuff in your body unless you're exactly sure what it is. Then with the internet and everything, it's a wild, wild west out there. You don't, you know. And then, like, we turn on our iPads or computers, and it's like magic. Like, you know, I remember carrying boxes of cards to the computer center to get data out. Now my students laugh at me because I touch a button and the statistics pop out. I jump around like a kid on Christmas. Mm-hmm. And it's a miracle age. So I think kids grow up thinking, well, I just buy a pill. We'll fix everything. So I think, as parents, we need to kind of talk about kind of responsible use. And we know Americans are over-medicated in general. And I think that's a discussion we may want to talk. And again, part of it's education. We have a grant right now with the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency to look at some national data and with Lance Armstrong and the things now. They're very concerned. It ties into some of the other things we talked about ethics education. So why is there a culture that Lance Armstrong cheats for 10 years? Why is that acceptable? And we think a lot of it goes back to some of the things in youth sports where you do anything to win. No, you don't. You strive to win and you do anything within the rules. But how do we help kids learn what moral standards are and make good moral judgments? And, you know, if we look historically, we've always said sport builds character. And I believe that, or I wouldn't be here under the right conditions. But if that's the case, was Enron caused by Little League? You know, because about 10 years before the Enron and some of the scandal on Wall Street, we had these controversies in Little League about lying about ages. Mm-hmm. So if kids learn good values from sport, if they learn to cut corners, if they learn to cheat, if they learn it's okay to take anything to get ahead, then why wouldn't 10 years later we be dealing with that problem? So I think early intervention, education.
But most parents, I mean, I've watched my friends, I'll say, who are not very good consumers of the things that are there because they want to feel healthier. There's a sense that all these things are really good for you. And if they're being sold, they must be good for you because somebody would have stopped them from being sold. But it does develop some tendencies that become more difficult, particularly if you put, let's say, a young man, a young woman in a position where they want to play more, their parents want them to play more, the coach wants them to play more, and you don't want to be called wimpy or or anything because you're not tough enough to do that. So there is, I think, developing for lots of reasons, culturally or around sport, not a very good conversation about what this means. Now, if I'm the great swimmer, let's say, and I'm picked out at 12 to be, because right now we were picking out kids really early to be great, okay, this elite athlete, whether you're a gymnast or you're a swimmer or you're a runner or in some cases you're a hockey player because of I get to play at the highest level in my traveling team and leave my friends behind. But those are really unregulated in terms of or don't have information that others who are part of this younger Olympic movement might have. So how do we get people to think and talk about this and understand what they're reading and getting?
Well, I think there's the internet is, on one hand, this great thing that educates us all. On the other hand, it's this, you know, if I'm a predator, it's the best thing ever. If I'm a dirty, rotten scoundrel. So, you know, somebody once said at the library, it might have been you actually, but at the library, we always had someone approving what books come in. Now nobody approves anything. So I say go to trusted sources.
Well, it's not approving, it's reviewing.
Yeah, reviewing. And
right.
And
so you get a peer review of it. When you publish a book, I publish a book, you publish a book, we go through a whole bunch of editors. People are doing content checks on our work in order for me to publish a book, in order for you to publish a book. It's true in referee journals, Nature, you can't get an article in without 10 other people looking at it and deciding if your facts are credible. Mm-hmm. On the internet, there's no such, it's not really controlling, there's just no such peer review process that gives a quality assurance.
But if it's in writing, it's true.
Yeah.
I read it on the internet.
But I think one thing that we're trying to get people to do, like if you go to the American College of Sports Medicine, look at their website, it's pretty solid, and you're going to get that. If you go to the U.S. Tennis Association, I do a lot of work with them. They have a superior sports science site, and there's experts on there. So I think trying to go to sites that are pretty credible, like the U.S. Tennis Association, American College of Sports Medicine, I think we need, as a university, that's a huge role for us, letting people know, like, this is a pretty good protected brand, vetted website that you could go to.
So if I wanted to know what those are as a parent, where would I find them? On your website, on our website? How could I get that information?
Probably contact us would be one, and we could get back to it.
Us meeting
the Institute for the Study of Youth Sport at Michigan State.
Okay, so mm-hmm. That's a resource for
people. That's a resource. I think going to the U.S. Olympic Committee website, organizations that are stable, been around a long time, any of your sport governing bodies like U.S. Tennis, USA Wrestling, will direct you to the Olympic Committee, which has a variety of resources that they usually on those sites don't put it up if they're vetted. If it's some site you're not sure about, you've never heard the name, doesn't mean it's bad. but I just would be more guarded than sort of like a Michigan State or a U.S. Olympic Committee, where we think the information is more vetted.
Well, I think, as I said off the top, I'm bubbling with more questions now than when I even started. And we've talked about the youth. We talked about transition into the business world. And there's so much in the middle, both from my NCAA role as well as Michigan State, that I'd like to sit down and share with you either in front or behind a microphone. Okay. But we really enjoyed having you here today. You've already got a couple emails from me, and you're going to get a couple more soon. I'd just like to engage more because I think it's a fascinating connection and makes such a difference in our lives, and we appreciate what you do.
Well, and Dan, I want to thank you. I mean, I think it's important to note that this has been work that Michigan State has been doing for a very long time, that it's not simply because there's a hot issue now about concussions or one of these other, you know, more visible things because the President of the United States has decided to raise the issue. This work has been very persistent. It's something we're doing not only in the laboratory, but with sports groups and with people around the state. And you are a great, your unit is a great resource. So thank you for taking on this important work on behalf of the children of not only Michigan, but the world.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
That was Dan Gould, director of MSU's Institute for the Study of Youth Sports, talking to Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis and Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon. Dan and his colleagues are online at youthsports.msu.edu. And to hear this conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Whether you're moving across town or across the country, relocating to a new job or a new city is always a challenge. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, wherever you go, you'll have an instant circle of friends on hand to help you get settled and get connected. With more than 100 clubs and affiliates around the world, there's a Spartan in just about every city. And as an MSU Alumni Association member, you'll quickly feel right at home. Wherever you go, community, connections, careers, and class, 4 great reasons to visit alumni.msu.edu today to activate your membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. That's alumni.msu.edu, the Michigan State University Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
Turn it up, a little bit higher. Radio, turn it up, burn it up, so you know. Radio.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.